Hello, this is Christine.
Hello, this is Heather.
And we took a left at the valley.
Fantastic.
And we... Oh, should I say it too? No,
sure.
I know we shouldn't have to scream that we're atheists. You know, we don't have non-astrologers and all that. But with the religious people taking over the world, I mean, we can either speak up or be pushed into a corner.
I'm proud to be an atheist, a skeptic, a non-believer, an infidel, a heathen. I call it how I see it. I say it's ignorance and you just call it faith in unsubstantiated claims. That's something to be ashamed. I'm an atheist.
Coming at you from Holier Than Thou, Abbotsford, BC, this is Left of the Valley. My name is Kevin, and one night I figured out I'd let my girlfriend make the first move. And then she decided to move to another town.
Oh my gosh.
Joining me as usual is a team considered a misdemeanor. The more they miss, the meaner they get.
True. So true.
She said the great thing about masturbation is that you don't have to dress up for it, Nancy.
Oh, okay.
You don't know the struggle of being a woman.
And she thought Gargoyle was an olive-flavored mouthwash. Christine.
Oh my gosh, I totally would. I'm so fun like that sometimes.
And she started Frisbee-tarianism, which is where you die and your soul flies onto the roof and is stuck there forever. Kirsten.
I have no words for that one.
I will adhere to that religion right there. Guys, welcome back. Hope you had a great week.
I've had better.
Okay.
I'm back.
Yes, you're back.
That has been good. Kirsten is back.
Let's put it this way. We're all glad the week is over and we're here.
Yes, exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. Yes. So today we'll be talking to Andrew Jasko. So that's going to be very interesting. But first, let's do a bit of chit-chat. Okay. We are coming on a 50-year anniversary. This is for our listeners. And if you guys have some questions you want us to answer on the show about behind the scenes or stuff like that, you know, where did Nancy learn her assassin trade, et cetera, we will answer these questions. Make sure to send them to us either via the website or leftatvalley@outlook.com. Now, this is interesting because I gotta give a little shout out to a buddy named Raj. Raj sent me a friend request, and he also became our first patron.
What?
Now, the funny thing about this is I had opened a Patreon page like months ago. Well, I never talked to him about the show because I didn't think I'd finished it. And I also didn't think it was active. apparently, it's been active all this time. So if you want to support us, patreon.com/LATV. So Raj sent us, he's become our first patron, and he says he's discovered the show recently, and he likes the show, and he likes to encourage us. So thank you so much, Raj. I really appreciate that.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll second that, because I got an email from Raj as well. It was a lovely email.
Yes.
And yeah. It's nice to know that we have a fan in Philadelphia. This is really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I sent him back, I hope, another lovely email to match his. But welcome, you know, is our fan and our patron. We're so glad you're one of our
patron.
Listeners.
We should almost do something special for him.
I know.
And thank you for getting me off my ass. I should try to finish the Patreon page now.
And
thanks,
guess who else he likes? Arn Raw.
Yes, yes.
I mean, how could you not hold. Like a guy who likes Arn, right?
He described himself as a bit of a atheist podcast junkie, and you know, he's got a whole bunch of them that he's supporting, and we're one of them now, so he's discovered us recently, and thank you so much for joining us, Raj, and hopefully we can continue to make you laugh and inform you a little bit. Okay, I want to do another little shout out to one of our co-hosts who's not here today, Dominic. Dominic, buddy, I know you're listening. You need to know I got your back, okay? That's all I'm going to say. All right, keep moving.
Hey, we all have his back.
Absolutely.
Apparently, did you guys hear, there's a growing trend, well, you guys know, there's a growing trend of adults refusing to vaccinate their kids.
Yes.
And that's a problem.
Oh, I hate these people.
Well, what you might not know, there's also a growing trend of kids...
getting measles.
No. Yes, but no, that's not what I'm looking for.
Not that one.
There's a growing trend of kids going on Reddit and trying to get vaccines without the parental consent.
I've heard of that as well. That,
I told you that generation is actually smarter than the older generation.
Yep.
I told you.
And it's kind of sad when the kids are like, okay, we know this is a good idea, but our parents don't. So how can we like go behind their back, essentially, so we can actually, you know, not die.
Apparently, in most states, you have to be 16. They will respect your privacy. Mm-hmm. They won't necessarily inform your parents. But you need to be 18 for parental consent about getting a vaccination. Vaxopedia.com apparently has a list of 15 states where no consent is actually required. So I would encourage people in the states to look up that page. Did you guys hear that apparently some Israeli scientists believe they will find a cancer cure within the next year?
Really?
I hope so. That would be nice.
Mm-hmm. It's called the AEBi anti-cancer treatment. It uses multi-targeted toxin as a cancer antibiotic, if you wish. And the cancer it attacks three receptors of the cancer cell at a time, which means that the cancer cell doesn't have time to evolve, mm-hmm. because you can evolve to try to block one receptor, and you can, you know, by reproduction, but it doesn't have time to do all three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think recently, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's also some Canadian researchers who are close to a cancer cure. I'm mm-hmm. using that word advisedly. And it looks like, you know, in various parts of the world, there's research that's really hopeful so that within the next 2 or 3 years, perhaps for some forms of cancer,
yes.
there will be a cure. Now that there are the targeted pills that are working on certain types of cancer, I don't know whether the new research goes an entirely new direction mm-hmm. or takes that as its foundation, but that's really great news.
It's great news. Also, yeah. maybe the word cure is not a right word, because this is not like a virus. I think a lot of people get confused with thinking of cancer cure is going to be like a polio cure or something like that. It's not mm-hmm. a virus, not an outside body. There's so many different types of cancer, and they all respond differently to certain treatment. But also with the advent of genetic testing, mm-hmm. they're also figuring out that by knowing your genetic code, there are some medicines that they can actually prescribe to you, you will respond to, as to another person would not.
Yeah, it would have to be,
tailor-made for you.
I guess it would be, you know, a specific type of cancer rather than umbrella.
Yeah, you're not going to have an umbrella thing.
I can't see that. Happening.
Which, of course, also debunks all these people that think, oh, they've had a cancer cure forever, they just don't want to release it because they make more money at it. Yeah. No, it's not like that. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
If cancer was an outside virus that would attack you, maybe you'd have something there. But since cancer develops within yourself, it's not something you catch. It's something you develop. Anyway, we could go on this, but that's a great show. We should do that. Uh-huh. Did you guys hear that? This is from the LA Times. They report that 15% of children death in the U.S. is due to guns.
I did see that.
15%. You talk about over 3,000 kids in 2016. Which is actually more than pediatric cancer, which was 1853, and childhood drownings at 995, and poison and drug overdose at 982. And this was compiled by the University of Michigan. Only the car accidents, which was 4,074, was actually worse. Mm-hmm. Wow, when you think that one of the greatest cause of death for a child in the U.S. is guns... And you know the funny thing is, every time there's a child drowning somewhere, everybody goes, oh my God, I can't, but people, watch your kids. When it comes to guns, it's like, just shrug your shoulders.
Wasn't there a group of doctors or pediatricians last year that declared guns a health hazard, a national health hazard? Am I remembering correctly?
That does ring a bell.
Yeah.
That does ring a bell.
So this goes along with that declaration last year.
Yeah, they'd be correct to do so. Mm. Okay.
It's like, people, if you have guns in your house and you have kids, lock them up.
Lock the kids up.
I grew up in a house with guns. The guns were in a safe. The bullets were in another place, and the keys were in a totally separate place.
Yeah,
none of them were together.
Right, and I think if you lock the kids up, solves the problem.
Yeah, lock the kids up in the safe. You know, make sure there's an air hole.
Yep.
We can get some letters.
Don't actually do that, people.
Yes. Don't take your children's advice on a podcast.
Yeah.
Did you guys hear that the girls will now be able to join the Boy Scouts? Now it's official.
Why would they want to?
Well,
Girl Scouts is so much funner. Girl Guides, the best.
So now I guess the Boy Scouts will be renamed just the Scouts. The Cub Scouts have already, which is like the younger version of the Scouts, have already welcomed 77,000 girls last year.
Wow.
Nice.
Well, I think, Christina, one of the reasons that girls might want to is because by combining the scout programs, the girls now have access to Eagle Scout
yes.
and some of the other true. Badges yeah. that lead them more into leadership
yeah.
roles that give them
yes. That's exactly
a leg
it.
Up in terms of professions mm-hmm. and things like that. I think they're still going to call it Boy Scouts of America, but they're going to use just BSA.
Yeah.
So there's still some buggies in the mm-hmm. in it, but overall, I guess most girls who are in the scouting program are in favor of it, not all of mm-hmm, them. Mm-hmm, so yeah. we'll just have to see at the end of a couple of years how it works mm-hmm. out.
As long as it can change those Girl Guide cookies. I you know, everybody likes them. I just can't stand them. I was like, what the hell's wrong with people?
All of them are just certain?
I did. They're just horrible.
You know what's funny is the thing about Girl Guide cookies, and this one I found, because I was also in Girl Guides. Whenever you have the mint ones, everyone wants the vanilla and chocolate ones. And whenever you have the vanilla and chocolate ones, everyone wants the mint ones. So here's an idea. Switch the time of year that they're out at.
Yeah, maybe so.
I think they used to taste better years ago, but that may be nostalgia rather than actuality.
They're mechanically reproduced cookies. They're not like homemade, right? So
yeah.
it's quite possible that the factory is just cheaping out. Last but certainly not least, many, many shows ago, we talked about a Greenland shark and that was estimated to be between 272 and 512 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So they're still trying to determine if that shark is actually that old. And it would make it the oldest vertebrate on Earth. Now they find out that it's probably closer to 272. Because the margin of error actually puts it between 272 and 512, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem with sharks is, you know, if you really want to know, you'd have to kill it, of course.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that. But sharks have, Greenland sharks have, they have a lens over their eye. And that lens keeps growing. They like layers of that forms over their eyes with every year. So you can kind of count them like tree rings. So that's how they're determining whether that shark is actually that old.
So I guess 272, big deal. The whole
yeah, I know.
Point,
when you're 5,000 years old, I know it's easy for you to say.
Yeah, when you pass 150. But when you realize that the tissues and the cells keep renewing, or they don't seem to die off, however the renewal works, or how the system, you know, their system just keeps going through the boy, am I ever getting mixed up and trying to say something simple. But what is it about the shark system that keeps it going? And eventually, is some beauty company going to say, yeah, here's some shark extract that's going to keep you looking 20 even though you're 97?
Well, it's a shark that's hard to get, first of all, because it lives in Greenland and very cold, very deep waters. Mm. So it has a very kind of slow metabolism. It moves slowly, you know, it doesn't expend a lot of energy. It conserves everything, you know. It takes its sweet time. And it's a bit like the turtle of the seas in a way,
but
right?
But even so too, I mean that's a long time for organs to keep functioning.
I just get an image, you know, if you get these layers, that lens that goes over your eye and it gets thicker and thicker, like do the really old sharks have like Coke bottle glasses over their eyes, you know, at some point, you know? That's going to be interesting. So anyway, we're keeping an eye on that.
Fascinating
indeed. Yeah. Perfect. All right, my dear Nancy, you got yourself a top 10 for us?
I sure do.
By the way,
yes.
Today is Groundhog Day.
Really?
It is. It's February 10th.
Yes, and Donald Trump came out, didn't see a shadow, so there won't be a wall for another 6 weeks.
Good news. Okay, this top 10 is to make people happy and never have another boring job again. Which is a big order.
I need that list.
But the list is, this is from an original list of 32. I pared it down to 10. And it's from a website called tradeschool.net. And it lists fun jobs that you can get that pay pretty good money. And they're unusual fun jobs so that you don't have to do the same old thing and just collect your paycheck and be tired of it all every
puppy
week.
Puppy cuddler.
Well, we know podcasters now and on list.
Well,
it's a fun job, but it doesn't pay.
Well, We'll see. Maybe they were ignored. Maybe they should have been number 32 and we're down to 10. But let's start with number 10. And number 10 fun job, according to this list, is sommelier.
Oh,
which
what
is drinking wine, attending posh events, meeting interesting and famous people, and impressing them with your remarkable wine knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
What could
that's
be better?
A job?
That's
are you
an
kidding?
Actual
it is
job,
a job.
And the average annual salary in the U.S. is a little over $46,000 a year.
To talk about wine.
You have to be trained,
oh, yeah,
but it's a professional job. And in the higher end restaurants and resorts, it's a really good position.
Like, Christina, have you seen these jobs where these people have the bottle of champagne and they open it with a sword?
Yeah, okay.
That's
yeah,
a job. That's
that.
A, well, it's not a sommelier, but that's a job too. And apparently that pays through the nose as well. A bottle with a sword. That's
well,
a job.
It's quite a skill because you can see a lot of fails where stuff like that goes
wrong. Oh, I'm
wrong.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's
but
a
anyway,
skill.
For those people that, you know, drink a little wine and enjoy
a
it,
little.
Why not rise to the top? Yeah. And
wine.
Bring a sword along with you.
Bring a sword along with you.
Okay, number 9, sort of in the same vein, food critic.
And that could be fun.
So the fun factor there is you get to dine for free at some of the best restaurants if you get a good job with a newspaper or a magazine that you can aspire to that. You also have servers and chefs give their all to ensure that you love them and impress, and you get to impress others with your culinary knowledge.
Now, I got to give you guys a little story on this. I did that. I wasn't a real food critic, but what I did back then when I was a lad, I borrowed a credit card from one of my friends because back then security wasn't all that great, right? And I went to a restaurant with my best dress suit with a pad, and I came in and I said, I want the specialty of the house, and I started writing notes and had the best service ever. The best service ever. It's like, oh, complimentary this, complimentary that. They were just all over me.
Oh my God.
I bet. Did you ever write anything up?
No, I just pretended.
You got all the goodies with none of the work.
They thought I was a food critic, and I just walked in there and out of her.
Now, if you had followed your inclination to do that, you would have been making a salary somewhere around $47,000.
Not bad.
Not bad. And it goes, I don't know whether it goes up or down from there, but it certainly is a fun way. That you have to maintain your good weight, though. That's a problem with all that good food. Number 8, NASCAR mechanic.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Anything that's mechanic.
Yeah.
Just don't make friends with the drivers because they're probably going to die.
Yeah.
That's dark.
Yeah, but the fun fact, taking that, you know, leaving that aside for a minute, the fun factors on that is that you get to join the racing circuit.
Yep.
You enjoy the thrill of all the racing events around the country. You get to know professional NASCAR drivers on a first-name basis. And their entry-level salary, this is surprising, their entry-level salary is anywhere from $45,000 to $65,000.
Oh.
Not bad if you're a pretty good mechanic.
Actually, I kind of thought it'd be way higher than that for a NASCAR.
Yeah. Okay,
that was entry-level.
Yeah.
That's entry level. Okay, so here we go. This is, you wouldn't think this is a job, but this is number 7 on a list of 10. Fortune cookie writer.
What?
I love that one.
We should do that, guys. We should make our own fortune cookies.
Yeah, the fun factor on that one is you get paid to use your wit and wisdom to produce sometimes thought-provoking and sometimes memorable one-liners that appeal to the masses.
But they have to be very vague.
You know, it'd be fun to have a fortune cookie company, but all the fortunes are like horrible. They're just on purpose horrible, you know. You will draw from a 10-story window or something like that.
I'm sure there have to be some kind of horrible fortune cookie boxes out there.
You call
it
the horrible fortune cookie company.
Have it like fortune cookie roulette.
Some okay, dog will bite you.
Now, here's surprising that came from this legitimate website. Whether you believe it or not, last year, the average annual salary for a fortune cookie writer, and I haven't done any research, but if you're interested, research this out. Average annual salary, $74,440 U.S.
Whoa.
I know. Wow. I know.
Jeez.
Isn't that something? Does it change your mind about sitting and writing little one-liners on teeny tiny pieces of paper?
Well, how many one-liners do you have to write a day? That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
Well, you'd have to look into that.
You think they have like a miniature typewriter?
I don't think.
Well, you've got English on one side and Chinese on the other.
And then
so
you put random numbers on the back of it, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's right. The numbers are on the back. Okay. Number six, moving up from sitting at the desk writing for little cookies, Hollywood stunt person.
Oh, yeah. They definitely get paid well.
I know a couple of them.
Yeah, so that fun factor is you can pretend to be a famous actor, actress, and perform jaw-dropping, possibly death-defying stunts that will, at the very least, make for some great dinner conversation.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the average salary is for that?
$60,000?
Close, $70,000.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, not bad. Okay.
You get to fly to LA on a regular basis.
Or just to live there.
Number five.
Or live in Vancouver.
Yeah, number five, which I think would be fun for a really creative person, is toy designer.
That's
a real thing.
Toy designer.
Yeah, the fun factor, you can forget being an adult and spend your days playing with toys, let your imagination run free, and create cool and innovative toys that appeal to kids, and you get to play with a lot of kids, too.
Want to invent a Nancy action figurine.
Yeah.
With Kung Fu Grip.
Well, you get to be a toy designer, and I'll be the very first
miniature Uzi.
Miniature toy with an assortment of assassin weapons. I think we got something.
That'd be beautiful.
You think we could do this by next Christmas and, you know, really make some money?
Left out of the valley.
Because the average salary is around $71,000, which is close to Hollywood stunt person.
That's not bad.
So, yeah. But then you and I would split
you can be the stunt person.
Yeah.
And I go design the toys.
We'll figure it out. Close to that at number four, and this is going to appeal to the ladies sitting in front of us here, video game designer.
You know, I actually considered that for a career.
See, I knew it was.
That was actually in my, like, I want to do this.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, there's no way.
I know.
There's no reason you can't start now, because here's the fun factors.
We'd have to move to Alberta.
Yeah, so...
No, we wouldn't.
So here,
but to be with BioWare, we would.
Yeah, so here are the fun factors that they list, and then after I read them, let me know why you wanted to do it. The fun factors they list is that you can be a creator of the next red-hot video game that hit the market. You might be able to model characters and scenes based on the people and places in your own life. So what was it about the job that was attractive to you?
It was just because I love playing video games and just that creative aspect of... I couldn't decide what I specifically wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in, like, maybe character or, like, the world creation.
Mm-hmm.
And just being able to create these kind of dynamic characters that people would then get to fall in love with.
Oh, so what do you think your average salary would have been?
Oh, 80,000.
I actually would have researched this, and I cannot remember.
90,000.
83,000. A little over 83,000.
Yeah, I'm in.
Well, Kirsten, we're moving to Alberta.
Yeah.
Guess what?
Pretty good.
The fun thing is when I was a kid, your parents would totally discourage you from playing video games. But today, you almost can't do that to your kid.
The parents play video games now.
But you almost can't do that to your kid because it might actually legitimately become a career. Playing and designing video games.
There are tournaments where people play sports as video games.
Yes.
Tournaments.
Actually, the Aquilini family that owns the Vancouver Canucks just bought a virtual sports team.
Yeah.
So I was like, are you kidding me? This is going to be like the next big thing.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so number three, this is kind of a surprising one, but it is for fun games, Ferrari driving instructor.
I'm sorry, what?
Ferrari driving instructor.
Well.
The fun factor is driving Ferraris for a living. They don't list any more fun factors. That seems to be, so if you're a single focus fun factor person, and the average salary, $89,000.
I mean,
now that was an instructor for
an instructor.
It, correct? See, that would be all great, except for when you're doing after you've told them what to do and taking them through a run through or whatever, when you end up in the passenger seat. I hope you're a little bit of a daredevil, because if somebody wants to learn how to drive a Ferrari, there's a reason for it.
Well, the fact that they're getting instructions means they're not totally crazy.
No.
Yeah, that's true.
Because otherwise they would have just started
maybe there's
driving.
Also that brake pedal on the passenger side that you can use as well.
I didn't research this, Kirsten, but maybe you could, is to look up a Ferrari driving instructor to see if there are any openings and see what they list as the what kind of resume are they looking for?
Probably having driven a Ferrari.
A good point.
Yeah, I wonder if there are driving instructors for the other, you know, high powered.
It's a good question. It's a good question. Lamborghini instructor.
Okay, number two.
Some people can barely parallel park.
Number two, and this is a surprise. This was kind of a fun one. Well, it's a fun list. Ethical hacker.
Wow. Like a white hat?
You make good money hacking into computer systems.
You're security.
Yeah, so a white hat.
And hacker. Then you can take pride in knowing that you have the upper hand over black hat hackers. Average salary, $99,000, almost $100,000.
Wow. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Would you want to do that?
Oh, I can barely turn the computer on.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, number one.
My computer said the other day it couldn't locate the printer. I typed it's on your left.
So if you were making a list of fun jobs, what would you put as number one? Then I'll tell you what this list is.
Zookeeper.
Yeah,
there's a good one.
I wanted to be a zookeeper.
Yeah, I'd be your assistant. That's a fun one.
I'd want to feed the giraffes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to see you guys feed the lions.
Yeah. So, Kevin, what would be your fun job?
Oh, God. I don't know off the top of my head.
Too many fun things to choose from, huh?
Well, you know, the thing is, I've been so brainwashed to think as a job as not something fun. That now you're putting me on the spot and think of a fun thing to do for a job, and I have a hard time coming up with something.
I think that's one aspect of millennials that we have over others. It's because millennials weren't taken in by the idea that, work is just...
Yeah, exactly.
You earn money and work so you can retire.
Because
my generation's like, well, why would we do something we don't enjoy?
Yeah.
Because you know what? We aren't going to make enough to retire.
Because you're asking me dream job, and my job, I went to like astrophysics or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's a great job. It could be a dream job, but is it really a fun job? I don't know.
Well, if you really enjoy it.
Why take a job if there isn't a fun aspect to it?
Yeah.
Kirsten, other than video designer, any other fun job?
Horse trainer.
That's you.
Yeah, that is me.
It's funny that we're all sitting here and nobody is saying, podcast person.
Yeah. Well, because we're already doing that.
Yeah,
I mean.
That's true. But it's fun. I think it is fun. That really is our fun. You know, that's our fun of the week for sure. Okay, number one, according to this list, is private island caretaker.
The
fun factor, soak up the sun, go on adventures, and pretend that it's your very own island.
Yeah, you just have to be antisocial because you ain't going to be hanging out with people much.
So you can bring people on the island pretending it's yours, right?
I guess it depends how you get on and off. Annual salary is up to $100,000.
Well, I guess it depends how big the island and how much work there is to do, because it's almost like you're landscaping at this point, right?
Groundskeeper.
Not sure landscaping, even if it's a private island, I'm not sure a lot of landscaping on a private island is all that great.
Yeah, but and it is a real job. I think it's on what's the TV show. There's so many of them, but there's a real estate show calling Finding Your Own Private Island.
Yep.
And you can be in the Florida Keys or in other parts of the world. And there are a lot of private islands for sale. So it's conceivable that if you have the temperament and the right resume, you could be a private island caretaker.
Yeah, I guess so.
Not out of reach.
Only problem is the time of the year that the people aren't going to be there, that you're going to be there, is hurricane season.
Well, it depends where the island is, right?
Yeah. Most private islands are in hurricane territory.
No, I wouldn't know. Why would you think that?
Well, like, you think...
You get private islands right here off the coast of British Columbia.
Okay, that is true.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't think of that. See, I'm thinking like
tropical island getaway.
Tropical islands.
You know, you want to...
Oh, BC Private Island. Oh, my gosh, that would be amazing.
So if someone has their own island and you're looking for a team of caretakers who will also broadcast their podcast from your location, contact any of us immediately.
Send us a message.
Yes.
Because it's February here, and we'd like to find someplace warm.
I'm okay
it's
with this.
It's actually not cold here.
You want to hear something? A couple of weeks ago, I went to West Van, and they were building this tower full of condos, right? And I happened to bump into our old friend Wyatt Scott. Remember Wyatt Scott? Sure. Well, he was working with the construction crew. So Wyatt says, come with me. I'll take you to a tour. So I went upstairs to the penthouse. Now, this is one of those penthouses that you see in a movie where there's a pool and a waterfall on the roof.
Oh, my gosh.
And the view of the Burrard Inlet and all that stuff. That penthouse, as they're building right now, is going to go for $25 million.
Whoa. Yikes.
Wow.
Now, I couldn't help but think, you know what? If I had $25 million to spend,
wouldn't get a penthouse.
No. Last thing I want is a freaking condo. You can get an island for that price. Why would you get your own private island for that price?
I'd buy a horse
I guess
farm.
If you don't want any responsibilities, everything would be taken care of by the maintenance in the building, and you can just enjoy it without any...
But then I can hire
also,
one,
also
I can hire one
really,
of you guys to take care of my island.
Some people really enjoy the
taste.
City.
Yeah.
Sorry, you saying?
I said some people really enjoy the city.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, it's like the rest of these condos in there were going for like $4 million apiece.
I get a horse stable
on that.
Well, it's pretty damn close to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's,
wow.
Anyway,
$25 million.
Ah, the things you could do.
If we pooled our money,
we would not have $25 million.
No.
Patreon goal.
Buy us a condo, guys.
All right, it's time for another brilliant moment. Brought to you by religion.
Oh, yes, it is. So, more than 20,000 people have signed a petition created by a Muslim who says Nike, the sportswear giant, needs to recall offensive shoe with Allah's name from the worldwide market.
Oh, Allah's name is on a shoe?
Apparently.
Oh, I can see the problem with that, right? Because they probably think that you're stepping on Allah's name every time you take a step.
I'm getting to that.
Okay.
The shoe in question, the Nike Air Max 270, does not insult Muhammad or even feature imagery from Islam. It just has a stylized font, common among brands like that, that vaguely resembles the Arabic word for Allah.
Oh, okay. I see what this is.
Yeah, yeah. Now you see where it's going.
Oh, yeah.
So here's what the petition says. Nike has produced the Nike Air Max 270 shoe with the script logo on the sole resembling the word Allah in Arabic, which will surely be trampled, kicked, and become soiled with mud or even filth. It is outrageous and appalling of Nike to allow the name of God on a shoe. This is disrespectful and extremely offensive to Muslims and insulting to Islam. Islam teaches compassion, kindness, and fairness towards all. After recalling trainers in 1997, which had a similar logo depicting the word Allah, Nike claimed to have tightened scrutiny on logo design. So why has a similar design been approved? We urge Nike to recall this blasphemous and offensive shoe and all products with the design logo resembling the word Allah from worldwide sales immediately.
You know, the irony of it all is the word Nike comes from Nike, the goddess of victory. So you have one goddess and then you have... oh, God. You know, I see so many of these images of Muslims that get really offended by this kind of stuff. They see a tuft of fur that kind of has this very vague look, or something on a watermelon that has this very vague look of the word Allah, and they all praise it, you know. Now it's on the shoe. That's blasphemy.
Yeah. Well, here's what it is. It's a stylized version of the word Air Max on the sole of the shoe, and it's kind of the R is kind of inside the M, and when you flip it upside down, that center part of it looks like the Arabic word for Allah.
Yeah, so you have to like really squint to see.
They're like turning it and looking at it like that. Yeah.
You have to be looking
it's
for
like
trouble.
Finding Jesus on toast.
That's exactly
it's exactly what it is. So the point is, our brains see patterns. It's just what they do. It's not the company's fault that their designs look to us like something that could possibly offend our imaginary friends. Nike has responded, as you'd expect, denying any intentional offense. Nike said in a statement the logo was a stylized representation of the Air Max trademark, and any other perceived meaning of our representation is unintentional. It said, Nike respects all religions, and we take concerns of this nature seriously. As previously mentioned, they did run into a similar problem in 1997, and the Council on American Islamic Relations protested the company's logo on certain athletic shoes, saying it resembled the word Allah in Arabic script. Nike said at the time it regretted any misunderstanding, explaining that the logo was meant to look like flames and recalled that line of shoes. So what do you guys think? Should they do the similar thing with this? Yeah, I don't think so
either. No, no. Leave it alone.
I mean, the key word there is that it resembles.
Well, yeah, it just, you know, says it Air Max.
You know, because they're not saying it is or it's offensive, you know, because it's obviously, you know, trying to, you know, be discriminatory. It resembles. Well, there's
you're looking
a lot
for
of
fleas
things that resemble.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I remember an image where they had a person, they had a skeleton and said this was proof of God, of Allah, because they had a skeleton lying on its side. And of course, if you look at a skeleton from the side, you have the feet pointing up, and then you have the legs, and then it made a circle around the hip, and then another circle around the skull, and that shape of the feet going down and the loop sort of spelled Allah for some fucking reason. And this was their proof of God. It was like, come on.
You're just looking for things that aren't really there.
Yes. It's called pareidolia.
Yep.
Oh. All right.
All right. I do have another one here.
By all means.
And this one's really interesting. Mind you, they're all interesting.
Well, hold on. Maybe I should put some...
Right, so there's an apologetics ministry called Stand to Reason that claims to train Christians to defend their faith. And in a recent email sent to supporters, founder Greg Kukul celebrated STR's work in action. He explained that one of his books has been used at a middle school Bible camp, and the camp counselor told him the teens left camp better equipped than in any prior year. According to the email, they knew the curriculum worked because they brought in an atheist to debate the kids, and the kids won.
Oh,
hold on.
Of course they did.
Did they bring like a real atheist, or they brought like a fake atheist?
I'll get to that in a minute. Here's the relevant portion of the letter that was sent out. Nick even staged a Stump the Atheist event to conclude the 5-day camp. He brought in an atheist, really a Biola student and STR listener, and the kids peppered him with questions, with many of them asking some amazing follow-up questions, even pointing out his inconsistencies. I was a bit nervous, Nick admitted. I wasn't sure anyone would rise to the occasion. But when the time came, after a week of training, the kids were armed and ready.
A week of training?
During the atheist roleplay, I was tearing up, Nick added. The material in your book proved to be an incredibly effective tool in equipping our youth this summer.
So essentially what they did is they brought a dummy, like a punch bag dummy, and they put it in the corner. Okay, kids, you go ahead and ask your questions. And after a week of trying to stop a guy who was obviously paid to just take a fall, they came out heroically better.
Well, this wasn't throughout the whole week. They had their week of their Bible camp, and then this was at the very end.
Oh, yeah.
They brought in an evangelical Christian to role play as an atheist.
Because they're so good at that.
I guess fake atheists wouldn't be on our list of fun jobs.
You know, I guess not. the funny thing is, they could have just grabbed a real atheist and, you know, have the kids have a go at it. But they do realize if you bring in a real atheist,
your kids are going to fail.
Yeah,
exactly. Your indoctrination is going to fail quick.
They might become atheists.
This just shows the hypocrisy of the faith, right? And this is what we always say, right? Between 4 and 14... They try to get the kids there because, you know.
But those kids are going to think, wow, we studied hard and we defeated that atheist.
Then they're going to go online and say, I don't get it. I gave him a Bible quote. Why doesn't he believe me?
Oh, exactly. Like, they do this against that fake atheist. And like, oh, we did so good. We were amazing. And then they're going to get into real life and be like, oh, shit.
Yeah. And heaven forbid they're going to bump into
a real atheist?
A real atheist, but one that's also a bit of an asshole.
Oh.
And he's just going to skewer them. It's like, oh, I feel bad for these kids. Religious trauma. Let's call Andrew back.
We'll send those kids to Andrew. They'll be okay.
Well, thank you so much for that, ladies. So let's take a quick pause. And when we come back, we'll be talking to religious trauma coach Andrew Jasko. That's going to be fun. So stay with us.
In a world torn apart by a lack of reason.
Or lease.
And I think it should be religion treated with ridicule and hatred and contempt. And I claim that right.
In the morning.
Hi, everybody. This is Robert Stanley from the Right to Reason podcast. And if you subscribe now, you'll get free.
Learn more about the broadcast at therighttoreason.com.
Podcast listeners,
we are the Godless Heathens Podcast.
Here's the details with no fine print.
You got new episodes available every other Sunday.
Sunday, Sunday, Sunday.
There's three of us, just like the Holy Trinity.
I'm Don.
I'm Jeff.
And I'm Jerry.
Coming to you from a spare bedroom in exurban Atlanta,
where we'll examine the crossroads of politics and religion, but from the secular perspective.
Sometimes we get heavy, sometimes we get deep.
And no one is above reproach or mockery, especially each other.
It's more of what you want and less of what you don't.
So open your hearts and minds to the Godless Heathens in your podcast rotation.
And you just might learn something, too.
And we have to realize that we are in a situation where people are flying planes into our buildings because they think God wrote their book and that they're going to get to paradise by dying in the right circumstances. And it seems to me a point of really exquisite obviousness that the response to this situation cannot be, sorry guys, God wrote our book and you're going to hell.
Well, our next guest is Mr. Andrew Jasko, who describes himself as a religious drama coach. He's a snappy dresser and a snazzy dancer. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us at Left of the Valley.
It's great to be here.
You say that now, you might regret this in a few minutes.
Well, we'll see.
Andrew, you and I have been talking here and there, but part of our audience probably doesn't know you. Maybe you'd be so kind to give us a quick bio as to who Andrew Jasko is.
Absolutely. So right now I coach people recovering and healing from religious trauma and biblical abuse, and I'm studying and training to become a clinical psychologist right now, getting my doctorate, and I was formerly a Christian Pentecostal evangelical minister before I left my religion.
Oh my gosh. Oh boy. Could have been worse. I guess it could have been a snake handler.
Yeah.
Jesus, that's a hell of a switch from being a Pentecostal minister to a guy who's about to get his doctorate in psychology.
Yeah. Who better to be a coach?
You know, yeah. it's kind of like the shadow side or the dark side of psychology.
Welcome
or
to the dark side.
So it's great preparation for my career, you know, because I know all the stuff, all the issues, and all the things to guard against.
Yeah.
And you also have this wonderful little page called lifeafterdogma.org. Maybe you'd be so kind to give us a brief description of that.
Absolutely. So that's my blog and website, lifeafterdogma.org. I constantly write about exposing the abuses and trauma of religion. So the psychological harm that's caused by religion. And a lot of people take an intellectual perspective to religion and point out its intellectual difficulties. But I focus more on the psychological issues and traumas and harm that's caused by religion. I don't think we pay nearly enough attention to it. There are so many people suffering, mostly within religion. It's mostly the religious people who are suffering from religion. And then the people who have left and are trying to piece their lives back together. So I write and I speak and I put on workshops. I just put on a workshop called Reclaiming Sexuality from Religion. There's so much there. So, yeah, check out the blog. There's hundreds of pages of articles and resources for you. And lots of podcasts. And, I mean, I just did a 3-hour podcast on walking through the specifics of healing and rebuilding your life in the wake of religion.
Wow.
We need to, by any chance, you know Dr. Del Rey?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, oh, he's a great guy.
I was about to say, we got to get him in touch with Daryl. You guys are right up the same alley.
Yeah, he has a great organization recovering from religion.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So let's talk about religious trauma, because I think you made a very good point. Most of us, even as atheists, we have a tendency to think of what religion does to the outsider, what religion does to the LGBT community, and what it does to other religions, blah, blah, blah. But you just brought up the point that most of the victims of religion are actually within the fold of religion itself.
That's right. There are millions of people who are suffering from the impact of religion, and a lot of them are not even aware of it, or they're not able to acknowledge it because they're not able to put any blame on the religion. Any suffering that happens to you within religion is blamed on you, and that's mm-hmm. one of the mechanisms religion has of keeping people in. It's because you don't have enough faith. If you're suffering or if you're struggling with anxiety and depression, it's because of temptation or divine judgment, or it's just the growing process in faith or the dark night of the soul. Things like this are used to keep people from questioning their religion, but there's just all kinds of suffering that's going on for people within it. And I think this is probably maybe the number one reason that people leave religion too, is because they are suffering from the psychological impact, all the damage, all the fear, shame, guilt, sexual oppression that's going on within the religion. And after a while, they just can't take it anymore. That's why I left my religion, is because it gave me an anxiety disorder, a full-blown anxiety disorder. Wow. And I woke up to that fact, and that led me to question intellectually. That led me to leave. And remember, we're not primarily intellectual beings. We don't make most of our decisions by making a checklist of pros and cons. You know, this is why we make most of our decisions based on feelings and what works for us. And that's why most people are in religion. And my hope is that when people come to an awareness of the psychological damage, that they can heal and move forward. So that's what I'm doing.
Wow, that's a tall order. It's a really tall order. Do you feel that? I know this is going to be an interesting question, because if I was to ask to pinpoint a certain group of individual that you feel is really mostly affected by religion and its trauma, would you say it's women? Is it different orientation? Is there a particular group that really, really gets its ass kicked, if you wish, by religion on a regular basis, according to your studies?
Honestly, everyone in it. Mm. Everyone in the system. And there are so many huge issues and traumas that it causes. But really, it starts with judgments. Mm. The whole system is based on judgment. The Bible is, first of all, I like to call it biblical abuse, because a lot of people will try to distract us and create diversions from the issue and say it's the fault of religious fundamentalism.
Yes.
Or of a particular interpretation of the Bible. But all kinds of atrocious and harmful doctrines are right there in the scripture in very simple, plain and apparent language. A lot of the times we're not dealing with like Kant or really abstract philosophy. This is plain, straightforward commands that are very difficult to misinterpret. And it's in the Bible. The Bible is the source of the abuse. And if you read it and take the Bible seriously, you'll see all kinds of abuse. Mm-hmm. So it's based on judgment. It starts out with judgment. God condemns Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
He judges them. They've sinned. They're cast out. And throughout the Bible, judgment is one of the main issues: good and evil, right and wrong, obedience or disobedience. There's hell and heaven. And then in the end, in the book of Revelation, it ends with God and Jesus invading the planet with weapons of mass destruction and the plagues of Revelation, literally destroying almost all of nature, most of humanity, and judging people forever. So this system of judgment is inherently abusive. And because judgment is, it's really based on a system of justice that's motivated by revenge, retributive justice. It's about reward and punishment. And this doesn't really lead to healing. It doesn't lead to wholeness or to solving the problems of humanity. It just creates more. It's this blaming and shaming and guilting game. And it sure is a great way to control people and maybe motivate some amount of behavioral change, but it doesn't result in freedom or heart transformation or love, which are the things that we need to actually heal and to move forward and solve the problems of our world.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, if you wish, with your permission, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for half a second because I like doing that. You say one of the main motivation is revenge in the book. Doesn't that kind of go against what one of the most famous things in the book saying, turn the other cheek? That's kind of an odd thing to say that revenge is the main focus when the main character in the book says turn the other cheek, is it?
Yes. So in the Bible and in religion, there's a mixture of good and bad. There's a mixture of love and fear. Religion is not all good and it's not all bad. It does plenty of really good and amazing things. And religious people are mostly sincere, great people whom I really love and some of them I admire and look up to too. But the problem here is the mixture, and that's what defines an abusive system. And religion is an abusive, or at least Western religion, is an abusive system of oppression. It oppresses people. It keeps them in a kind of spiritual, moral, intellectual, and psychological slavery, which is preached explicitly in the Bible. But this mixture of good and bad is confusing, and it's why people stay. In an abusive relationship, yes, the abuser is not all bad, and that's why people stay. He's often a good guy. He might really be fun to hang out with. He might meet your material needs, but every so often he says, I'm going to kill you if you leave, and he beats you, right? Mm-hmm. So it's this mixture. That's what's confusing. That's why people stay. If it was all bad, the abuse would be obvious and everyone would leave. And in the Bible, there is a mixture of opposite commands. I mean, there's commands to murder. The people of God are commanded to commit genocide and ethnic cleansing and kill all of their neighbors in the book of Joshua. Mm-hmm. But then we have commands not to murder. And this is because the Bible is written by different authors over thousands of years who often disagreed with each other. And until you realize that, you can't really see it accurately.
Mm-hmm. And also I've noticed in the Bible, similar to what abusers as humans do, is they'll turn it around on you, like, oh, I only did this because you made me. Mm-hmm. So, like, with religion, a lot of times you hear, like, oh, God didn't send them to hell. They sent themselves to hell. And it's no.
Yeah. And you know what? That's an absurd argument. And people only make that kind of argument because they have to. The whole field of apologetics, I think, can be understood as making excuses in order to justify the unjustifiable, things that people would never support outside mm-hmm. of religion. And we have to judge all ideologies equal and look at the face of them and say, if this was in the book or if it's out of the book, would I support it or would I oppose it? And you have people who are forced to defend things they would never, ever support, and they don't support if they find them anywhere else because they're obviously atrocious. And if we step back from this intellectualizing that doesn't make sense, this logic that apologists do, and we just take a simple morality, like the moral reasoning of a child, that basic moral instinct that I believe we all have. There are some moral issues that are difficult. There are plenty of grays. But when it comes to something like genocide or eternal torture or human sacrifice, most children, I'm going to say 99%, would say, no, that's wrong. It's obvious. It's so obvious.
Well, Andrew, as a minister and being heavily indoctrinated in your religion, when you began to feel anxiety, what was it that flipped the switch for you so that you got the insight to know that it wasn't your anxiety, but it was your religion that was at the core of the problem?
So it was a process for me that took place over the course of years. And I was a Christian, totally devoted to my faith for all of my life. I was headed to India to become a missionary to convert Hindus and Muslims to Jesus, to bring about the second coming of Christ. That was my career goal. And I was just getting my Master of Divinity at Princeton Theological Seminary to learn the original Greek and Hebrew languages of the Bible and really study and learn this thing so I could train up leaders to convert their indigenous ethno-linguistic people groups to start churches in these different groups in India and lead to Jesus' second coming. But while this was all going on, I was suffering. And I now, looking back, I can see how I was suffering within religion because of religion. But at the time, I came up with alternative theories for my suffering. I thought it was psychiatric, or I thought it was a result of my lack of faith, or just kind of other issues, because I wasn't able to see that it was the religion at the time, because that would mean questioning my faith. And questioning your faith means putting your sense of safety in jeopardy, because if we lose our faith, we're taught that we can go to hell or face divine wrath or lose our community, all kinds of things. So that's a powerful psychological mechanism, that fear, that motivates people to intellectualize and to stay in their religion and not question it. Far more powerful than being right or wrong, I think. So what led me to question was I was just so miserable. I suffered from tons of anxiety, obsessive thinking, some depression. And I just said, you know what, I need to get better. I'm going to do whatever it takes to not live by fear anymore. I just can't do this. So I really prioritized my mental health. I took therapy very seriously. And as I did this, I just very quickly began to see, like, holy shit, there's so much that's psychologically toxic in this Bible and in this religion. And this is what is causing my anxiety. And the whole thing began to unravel for me. It was a slow, painful, rude awakening, because I wanted to keep that, because religion had meant so much to me. It provided a lot of my needs. It was my career. It was my passion. So it's really hard for people who are that entrenched to give it up. And it was my whole identity too. A religion functions as a total identity system, especially for fundamentalist forms of religion, not all of it, but especially fundamentalism, evangelical Christianity, which is the majority of Christianity in the world. And one full third of the United States is evangelical Christian, a full third. Wow. So this is huge. It's massive. It's absolutely everywhere. Where was I going with that? I lost my train. So I began to see how psychologically damaging it was. It was a process of about 2 years for me to leave and then quit my ministry job and really restart. And it was a total identity crisis, because religion can co-opt the identity. It literally takes over a person's identity, where a person almost becomes, where their personality is almost repressed. And the religion, like, sometimes you'll interact with Christians who are so in the system that it's almost like they're not even there. It's a religion talking to you, not the person. It's all about Jesus. It's all about what God's doing in their life.
Absolutely.
Because they're taught in the Bible that your body is not your own. Your life is not your own. You're bought with a price. You are a slave of God. The Bible literally calls Christians slaves. You are a psychological, spiritual, whole body, whole person slave of God. Every thought and idea and emotion and every life choice must be submitted to the authority of the divine ruler, of this deity called God, or else you could face judgment. And we're taught to police our thoughts. We're taught in Jeremiah, it says, Jeremiah 17, I, the Lord, search the thoughts, search the hearts to pay back everyone according to what they're done. So we have God policing your thoughts, this cruel, tyrannical thought policing, looking to punish you. And so you have to be totally submissive, and you have no identity. You're taught to surrender your agency, your critical thinking, your power, your responsibility. Everything must be under the authority of this authoritarian regime called the Kingdom of God.
You know, that is absolutely well said. And I also like the fact that how you're describing this as an abusive relationship. And it also describes the way we feel right here at Left of the Valley towards Nancy. Because she's the sweetest thing in the world, but she can just snap and kill us at any moment. So we placate her as much as we can. No, but you're absolutely right. The question I have, though, in all seriousness, is, being a minister, and you know your Bible in and out, I'm pretty sure, do you feel this was actually designed on purpose? Or was it just a horrible coincidence that the amalgamation of all these books created this effect of quote-unquote slavery?
This is a great question. And the more that I study religion and look at these psychologically harmful issues, the more I'm shocked, the more I'm absolutely amazed on just how systematic and pernicious this oppression really is. So I think it's an issue of both ends, not either or. There were a lot of historical influences that just came to be that we can understand why religion is the way it is. And at the same time, there were, religion is, functions as a power system. It benefits those at the top. And it has. I mean, these ideologies were used to support kingdoms and kings, and especially the religion developed with the nation of Israel as a means of mobilizing the people under the divine ruler Yahweh. So Yahweh is the Old Testament God. And before Yahweh became the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, Israel used to be a polytheistic people. Mm-hmm. And we see this even in that statement, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and like, who among the gods is like you? If you study the Bible, you can see that the Israelites used to believe in multiple gods and multiple deities. But so Yahweh emerged out of this pantheon as he was elected as the strong man to deliver the people of Israel from oppression. So they were oppressed by many foreign nations and just brutally, brutally oppressed. And so they... monotheism emerged, in part at least, as an attempt to consolidate the national identity as the people of God, and the religion was used to destroy their enemies and to commit war and really to advance a system that benefited the people who are in it. And we see this kind of a control emerging and continuing throughout the Bible. So that's one reason. But there are all kinds of reasons for it, and I do think some of it is definitely intentional.
Mm. So if you happen to stumble, I mean, you can't really diagnose something like that unless you talk to yourself or like a professional. But if you have people in your life that you suspect are a bit too much into the faith like that, how would you approach them to maybe have them start questioning? I mean, you can't usually use rational arguments with these people because it's not a rational argument they use to stay in the religion. It's often an emotional one. So how would you approach somebody that you're concerned about that's going way too deep into the hole?
Well, religion thrives in ignorance and isolation. And we see this in that societies that increase their education tend to lose religiosity. There's an inverse proportion to education and religiosity. And I mean, religion also thrived because it was married with state. Church and state, separation of church and state is a recent historical innovation, and people didn't used to choose their religions. Religion was mandated by the state. You were born into a religion and you didn't know any better. You know, the religious authority often presented themselves as God, or at least as having the authority of God, like with the Pope. And so you went along with it. You didn't know any better. It was impossible for you to know any better. So, but now it's harder and harder to be isolated in our world, in our globalized society. We are always interacting with other people who have different perspectives. So one of them is just honestly to interact with them and to kind of show your difference and to showcase that these things they consider sins are actually often very healthy, and that you are living in freedom. And so a lot of people leave religion because, for instance, they have friends who are gay. And so the religion teaches them that these are sinful people and that they're living in distress. But when they actually interact with people, this causes a cognitive dissonance where their ideology directly contradicts their experience, because they find out that these friends are living very happy, fulfilled lives, and that they're great people and they're very moral people, and they do this all without the religion. So I think a lot of it is just friendship, is non-judgment. A lot of times when we confront people, it causes them to become more entrenched because the religion is conflated with the identity in this system. Like, my religion is who I am, which is a problem because your ideology is not who you are. It's just not true. But religious people often feel threatened when we call their beliefs into question. That's not to say we shouldn't confront them. I do think that they need to hear the intellectual as well and to be challenged, but within that context of the relationship. So I think experience is really important. And really seeing how other people are happy and are doing well in the world and the benefits of secular society. So I'd say exposure, if I had to put it down to one word.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. It's really hard for a person that knows you as a good person, all of a sudden, if they hear that all atheists are just horrible people, say, well, that's not true. I happen to know Nancy, who happens to be an atheist, and she's a fantastic person, unless she pulls out her gun, of course. But... besides that, I mean, I think you're completely right. It's almost leading by example, and hopefully they will follow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it also helps for religious people to have spiritual experiences, or I guess you could say consciousness expanding experiences, which is ironic. And I use the term spirituality, by the way, as an atheist. I'm comfortable with that. Some people aren't. So you call it spirituality, mysticism, consciousness, whatever you want to use. I'm not implying that God or the supernatural mm-hmm. exists. So just so people hear that. But however you think of that term, I think that one of the great ironies of religion is it preaches spirituality, but it also suppresses it. So when I was in religion and I was in Pentecostal charismatic religion, a version that heavily emphasizes the miraculous and the spiritual, I never experienced any of it. Honestly, I experienced emotions and these like visualizations that were always questionable. Is this a trick of my mind, or is this God, or is this my voice, or is this God's voice? But having left religion now, I have these kinds of amazing, profound consciousness expanding experiences things like ecstatic states of total love and bliss, or a feeling connected to everything, or visions and visualizations, and just all kinds of amazingly profound experiences that are a result of me being freed, having full access to myself and my humanity, and not judging everything as good or bad.
Andrew, tell me something. As a guy who's studying psychology, what is it about humans that, you know, they can't seem to do things for their own benefit? Like, for example, if you go into the world of politics, for example, you know, like right now in the United States, the Democrats are proposing a 70% tax on the marginal tax on 10 million plus. Yet you have people that are very poor defending the very rich. And in religion, you have the same thing. You have, like, for example, women, you know, that are... treated absolutely horribly by all the monotheistic religion, yet they're always the ones, often the ones, on the forefront of defending the faith and giving it to the next generation. What is it about humans that we can't seem to read, put two and two together and realize this is just not good for us?
I think it's because there's a commitment to a higher commitment to the whole system and to the benefits of that system. So religion, the fundamentalist religion, functions as a whole package deal. It's an all or nothing thing. It's your total reality, your way of understanding everything, life, the universe, yourself, and all of it. And so to question one part of it throws the whole thing in jeopardy. So because of that, you're willing to defend all kinds of immoralities, injustices, and harms to yourself because of the higher commitments. Really, if you question this thing or if you lose it, then you lose your sense of identity. And a sense of losing your sense of identity in existential crisis can almost be seen as a death worse than death, than physical death. And you'll see that people will give up their lives in physical death in order to preserve their sense of identity or their morality. Mm. So really, this existential crisis we see as like the ultimate thing to avoid. So women will, say, defend oppressive systems in order to preserve this whole life system that their family might be based around, or their whole sense of identity and belonging might be based on, which, you know, you could see that as really having a priority.
One interesting thing that I think is an example of what you just said is that this week, Sarah Sanders, Trump's communication director, made the statement that she's made before, but I think it had more weight in that she insists that God wants Trump to be president, which puts the priorities in that if you don't believe in Trump, if you don't like Trump, then you're going against God. And it's weaponizing the religion to say, regardless of the horrible things that Trump is doing and the horrible person that he is, it's God's plan to keep him here. And it's a way to keep that base motivated to get behind him. And it was horrific, you know, to think of that kind of political control over people who believe that their religion is their identity.
It's almost like, you know, when you're watching a sports team and you're like a big fan and you realize you're going to yell at the umpire because of a call against your team, but you'll never point out when your team does actually something bad. You'll never point out. It's like the people really overstep. It's like it doesn't matter anymore the morality or the standards or the values of what the team is supposed to represent, as long as the team wins. And we see that in religion, and we see that in politics right now very strongly, which we didn't used to.
Yeah, so this is going to be the topic of a new article I'm going to write. It's about psychological splitting and dualism, and this is a root issue. So there's something called splitting in psychology, and it's the root of all kinds of neuroses like borderline personality disorder. It can lead to bipolar disorder, psychosis, narcissism. All these kinds of things, by the way, are reflected in tendencies of religion. But so psychological splitting is this: when we split parts of our personality into good and bad, and the world into good or bad, it's an all or nothing way of thinking that something's all bad or all good. And we see this it's a result of wounding and trauma, usually in early childhood, where in order to deal with rejection or pain or really difficult events, we protect the good aspects of our reality by splitting our personality into two, into a good part and a bad part, and viewing all relationships in terms of a good person and a bad person. So that way we don't have to face that the kind of the threat of the darkness of rejection or pain engulfing everything. We can compartmentalize it and separate it out and say, you know, this is my sinful nature. This is the bad me. And I'm a saint here. This is the good me. But what happens when we split, we view the world through a tainted lens. So we have good people and bad people. So for instance, you'll hear people who've been traumatized in relationships or with the other gender saying things like, all guys are bad. You know, women or men suck, right? You'll hear people doing this all or nothing category, and they're really projecting their pain. They're saying, I had a negative experience with the other gender, and this is how I'm protecting myself from that pain. And so this results, the psychological splitting disconnects us from ourselves. It keeps pain from overwhelming and destroying us, but it creates a dissociative experience of life. And we repress the difficult aspects of ourselves into an unconscious shadow self. And it keeps us from experiencing life because really emotional health is embracing the fullness of life, the painful and the pleasant. And when we become more healthy, we don't run away from our unpleasant experiences. We accept the difficult aspects of ourselves and of reality, and we integrate. And when we do that, we suffer less because we're not fighting and raging against our reality. We're not repressing things. We're not creating an additional layer of suffering. And so really, this whole, like, God and Satan is a result of psychological splitting, right? All of this character called God is all good. This character called Satan is all bad. And everything we do is either all good or all bad. And we can't see the grays. We can't experience the grays. We can't experience people as good or as gray people, or ourselves as gray people. So we have to condemn all these people who are different from us as evil and satanic or demonic. And what this does is it gets us to the idea of sin and original sin, and as a means of understanding human behavior. And it's the doctrine of sin is, I think, one of the most oppressive doctrines of all of religion. It's telling you, it's a doctrine of systemic shaming. It's telling you that you are bad, you're evil, your fundamental inclination is to do harm. And it's really a form of self-hatred. And really, this doesn't produce morality. It produces the opposite. I mean, if you tell people they're bad, they'll start to believe it. And we don't help people who are criminals, per se, or who do bad things by putting them under a system of rules or by telling them they have a bad nature. We help them by telling them they're not bad because they do bad things. We help them by not judging them, by saying this isn't who you are. This isn't your nature.
No, you're absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, when you talk to a lot of Christians, if you ask them a simple question, do you think people are fundamentally good or bad, they will tell you most likely people are fundamentally bad, which of course is demonstrably false. If people were fundamentally bad, the entire world would be a chaos, would just be absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
And you'd have killers around every corner, and you'd have, you know, and the funny thing is, that's exactly when you talk to them, that's exactly what they think happens. They think there is a killer around every corner. They think there is a guy with a gun that's about to rape you and mug you around every stone they can turn.
That's right, and the only thing that's keeping you good is your belief in God and in Jesus the Redeemer.
Yeah.
Without that, they don't feel that there's any natural morality at all. So you're now under the power of the belief. If I understand what you're saying correctly, Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Andrew's opening a huge can of worms here.
huge can of worms.
Yes.
But I would say the wounding and the abuse of religion. Well, I mean, I guess it starts with the dualism in that kind of a splitting thing I described, but then it really takes root in the idea of sin, which, by the way, no school of psychology subscribes to the idea of sin as a way of making sense of human behavior or the human personality. It's been completely invalidated by psychology. And this is part of why religions often, especially fundamentalist religions, resist psychology. Because psychology has recognized from the beginning, or at least especially since Freud, that religion is so psychologically oppressive. It's so harmful. It's so unhealthy. It introduces delusion, anxiety, fear, shame, a false identity, all kinds of things into the mix. But especially the idea of sin. It's been completely invalidated by psychology. Saying that you have a sinful nature doesn't make any sense. So this idea of bringing judgment, understanding the world by a system of judgment, rewards and punishment, good and evil, God and Satan. Again, I said that was based on splitting, which is based on a response to trauma and suffering. That whole way of judgment is the opposite of how humans heal. It's the complete opposite. That leads to more suffering. The way in which we get better and we heal the oppression and harms both in our societies and within ourselves is applying a perspective of non-judgment, of unconditional love, we could say, of positive self-regard. That's a term, unconditional positive self-regard, which means this: we bring awareness to our faults and our flaws and the issue, the dark sides of ourselves, the things that we tend to repress in religion and just shame and shove out of our consciousness. And we bring a non-judgmental, compassionate acceptance of them. And so I may have a problem with addiction, right? And in a religious system, what do I do when I say I drink in an addictive way? I say, you know, you're a bad person. Mm-hmm. Oh, crap, I'm under God's judgment. You know, I get afraid and I try to stuff and repress that part of myself and say I'm a sinner. And that only makes the addiction worse. That's just more repression. And that's self-judgment and shame. And self-judgment and shame will lead to more addiction, really. It creates more of the same problem. But when we start to have a different relationship with our problems, that shifts and it takes out the power of the problem. So when I have those addictive thoughts, I don't judge myself as bad. I start to notice it and say, that's interesting. I get curious about it and say, well, look at this. I'm struggling right now. I'm engaging this in addictive behavior, but I'm not judging myself. I'm not attaching it to my sense of worth. And it takes the power out of it. And the more we bring love, loving awareness, and non-judgment to our pain and our experience of suffering, we start to integrate the and accept those parts of ourselves that we don't like, and we start to actually heal from that trauma and that shame, and to be more free and to be able to make more conscious, empowered choices. So really, it's the way to health is literally the exact opposite of the idea of sin.
Also, the reason why Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't really work. No matter what they say, no matter how much they try to make it sound like it does. Sin has always been, as far as I'm concerned, an imaginary disease invented to sell you a religious cure. It really is that. There's no such.
That's right.
I mean, you ask most religious people, what is sin? Describe to me what sin is, and they can't really come with a good answer. They just say, well, something God doesn't like. Well, there could be a lot of things if you look at the book.
Well, Andrew, how do your clients, I don't know whether you call them, how do people come to you for help? How do they find out who you are and where to find you?
Yeah, they usually find me just through reading my blog articles or hearing some of the podcasts and talks that I've given. So usually through the internet, and they reach out to me that way. Mm-hmm. And just in person as well.
Do you have individual clients, or do you do group? How do you organize your therapeutic groups?
Yeah, I see individual clients. I've also put on some workshops, but it's mostly individual work.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to be part of Dale Reyes' secular therapy project once you finish your graduation? You get your doctorate there?
I don't think so. No. I think I'm going to mostly do my own thing. I'm studying for my doctorate right now, and I'm looking at doing my dissertation on the psychological harms of indoctrination. Mm-hmm. And also thinking of creating a training program for therapists and helping professionals on the abuses of religion and how to treat them. So that's my interest. But I'm also very interested in, again, spirituality and those experiences. And a lot of atheists, I think, just can get triggered or turned off by that. Mm-hmm. And by my curiosity about those, but I've found them to be so powerfully healing. A lot of teachings within Buddhism are amazingly sophisticated with how they deal with emotions and suffering, and talking about some of the what are called transpersonal states, different kinds of consciousness where I actually experience, and people regularly experience, a lot of the states and mystical things that are described by religions. Because remember, these are all a part of our human experience. Some people have had those within religion, but if we're to take a non-supernaturalist worldview, these things are realities. We just have to understand them in a different framework. But they shouldn't be just shoved out and dismissed because we associate them with religion, because religion can kind of steal them and rob us of the joy of having them.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us today and explaining all this to us. So give us again your email address if people want to reach out to you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Andrew J, J-A-S-K-O, Andrew J. Jasko at gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook or Twitter or on my website, lifeafterdogma.org.
Fantastic. And we'll put the links up in the notes of the show for people to find you. Andrew, thank you so much. You're a new friend. And before I let you go, I got to have you say, hi, this is Andrew Jasko, and I took a left at the valley.
Hi, this is Andrew Jasko, and I took a left at the valley.
And that was Andrew Jasko.
Oh, fabulous conversation.
Boy, did he cram a lot of information in that little short interview, man.
No kidding.
Boy.
Look at that guy go. I'm going to have to keep a serious eye on him because Dr. Jasko, that's going to be happening very soon. We'll come back on the show.
He's really got such a great personality. He sounds very warm. He's very communicative. I mean, if ever I want to give up my assassin addiction, he's the guy that I think he'd help me. I really do.
I think so, too.
Well, at least you can admit it's an addiction, Nancy.
That's the first step.
He might start to write his thesis about us from now on. Yeah.
So, I think we're thesis worthy.
I think so too.
Chris wants to invite us to his thesis presentation, why wouldn't be thesis worry, you know, for the secular side as well?
Exactly.
We're devout secularists. It'll work.
Oh, it's going to be great. Oh, thank you so much for joining us on the show, guys, and thank you for listening. You can follow us at leftoutofvalley.com. You can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, at LETV Podcast. You can help us on the Patreon now.
Go check that
Patreon.
Out.
Patreon.com/LETV.
Who knows, you might get some extra goodies over there.
Yeah, we'll put some stuff with some goodies, you know. The more of a patron you become, we'll thank you. We'll build a cathedral where you were born. We'll flower your mausoleum when you die. We'll be so ever grateful.
Yep.
Give us a 5-star review wherever you find us. That really helps us and helps others find the show. Okay, coming up next week, we'll be talking to Zach from the Zacrilege Podcast.
Nice.
That's going to be interesting. And on the 16th, we'll have Matt Dillahunty, the legendary Matt Dillahunty.
Coming up 2 weeks.
On the 23rd, we'll have the guys from Godless Heathen. That's going to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in March, we'll have the Skeptical Texans. And we'll also have... Oops. We'll have the guys from Atheist News with Steve DiMarco.
Oh.
That's going to be interesting. And of course, on the 23rd will be a 5-year anniversary show.
Woohoo!
That's crazy.
And at the end of the month of March, we'll be talking to our good friend Richard Carrier.
Oh, good way to start the 6th year off.
Yeah, exactly. Start with a bang, for sure. So we got lots of good things coming down the pipe, as per usual. Okay. Anything else you need to add to this?
Get a good night's sleep, guys, and drink water.
And to water. My little buddy Dominic. Buddy, I got your back.
And we love you, dude.
Yes.
Awesome.
We got your back, buddy. All right, guys. Thank you so much. Until next time. And the fact that he studies psychology means he can deal with us.
Oh, that's right.
Fantastic. Although he might write his thesis on us after this interview.
Oh, yeah.
I probably have enough religious trauma.
As long as we don't traumatize him, we're okay.
Andrew, is there somewhere you don't want us to go with this interview? I mean, mostly we're going to let you take us wherever you want us to go, but, you know, I don't want to ask a question that makes you uncomfortable or anything like that. Is there something you want to... off limits or something?
No, I write about all the uncomfortable things, so okay. Those are my favorite.
Fantastic.
Because there was something about a goat that happened the other day, and
Kevin was getting some uncomfortable feelings.
That's okay, Andrew. We just now gotten Kevin off of sex with furniture, so, you know, I think we'll be okay.
We can always come back to that.
We can. That's sort of our fallback conversation.
I think I visibly saw the picture of Andrew on Skype get darker all of a sudden. He's like, oh my god, I'm regretting this call right now.
Hey, no, this is like great material for his. He's like, could be like analyzing us all, like, okay, what mental illness does this one have? The perfect opportunity for him.
That's all I do. I'm proud to be an atheist, a skeptic, a non-believer, an infidel, a heathen. I call it how I see it. I say it's ignorance and you just call it faith. And unsubstantiated claims, that's something to be a